So, let's get started. At some point in the wee hours of this morning, I remembered that I haven't actually ever told you all about how the Gospel of Mary was found. It's not as funny as the story about how the Odes of Solomon were found, but before we start with prayer, let me tell you that somewhat funny story. The Gospel of Mary was found in, like a number of documents, in the market in Cairo. So by the 1890s, Europeans and some Americans had begun to notice that, scholars of the Bible had begun to notice that if they went to the Middle East, and especially if they went to Egypt, that they would, there was, you know, an interesting chance that they would find a very ancient document that no one had known about. And so those scholars would kind of go into the markets of Cairo. Anybody been to the markets of Cairo here? They're just, are they amazing? It's just like the most beautiful, amazing, intense hustle you've ever experienced. These guys are going there in the 1890s, looking for not the kind of lost treasure from the pharaohs, but old documents, and sure enough, one of the German professors that made the trip in the early 1890s takes a document home that is in Coptic and is the Gospel of Mary. And so he's pretty excited about that. And I showed you last, or 2 days ago, how these documents look. And actually, in the handout from yesterday, I think you probably saw these, and I'll pass this around if you didn't. The beginning here, you've got the actual photographs of the actual text of the Gospel of Mary. This is where there are no punctuation marks, no space between the letters, no capital letters. And so it's hard to do what we call establish the text. So this guy gets busy on establishing the text, which simply means figuring out which words are on the page, what Coptic words are, since they all run together. And then beginning to translate it in Coptic, that takes him a number of years. And then his work, as he's beginning to translate the Gospel of Mary, his work is interrupted by World War I. So things are bad enough in his part of Germany that he can't really continue his scholarly work. Then World War I eventually ends, and he gets back to, he has, in the meantime, just for the safekeeping, he has put the text of the Gospel of Mary in his basement. And then he has a water pipe break, which actually decimates the text itself, the papyrus. And so then he spends the next 3 or 4 years piecing the papyrus back together as best he can. And he does that relatively well. These days, one does that much better. So for instance, some of you remember when the Gospel of Judas was discovered about 15 years ago, the American speculator who owned it had hidden it in a freezer on Long Island, which also completely destroyed the papyrus. But he sent it to the University of Basel, which with computers completely reestablished the text and that papyrus. Anyway, this wasn't the case. It was harder in 1920s in Germany. And then he gets back to his work and he dies. So then someone else, a student of his in the late 1920s, picks up the translation. And that is interrupted with World War II. Finally, in the 1950s, a third generation of scholars finishes the translation of the Gospel of Mary for the first time, found in the 1890s, and is published in 1957. It's translated about a decade later into English. So in other words, about 60 or 70 years since the guy finds it in the Cairo market. Then one of the things that has been really interesting, of course, is that the scholars have not really known what to do with these texts, and by and large, they don't really share their work with the public. So the American public really only heard of the Gospel of Mary in the early 1980s, and real scholarship only began in the 1980s of what in the world does it mean? So in other words, it took about a century just to get the text there into kind of the mix. So that's what we've been reading. Let's start with the prayer. This is the prayer of the Apostle Paul. This was found at Nag Hammadi in 1945. I would suggest that we read together the first five verses of the prayer of the Apostle Paul to focus our time together. Grant me your mercy, my Redeemer, redeem me, for I am yours, the one who has come from you. You are my mind, birth me. You are my treasure, open for me. You are my fullness, receive me. You are my rest, give me unrestrained maturity. The last part of that, we'll probably read that, the last part of that prayer tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to be talking not about just about the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of John, but we'll take kind of a look back, at least on a feeling level, of this week, and we're going to just open the larger question of how do we think about recently discovered documents from early Christianity alongside the traditional New Testament. So we'll have a little bit broader focus tomorrow of our study. Today we're going to be talking about men and women in the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of John. We started that on Monday mainly with a focus on gender in the Gospel of John. So I want to begin today with just a little set of reports on how the last 30 or 40 years have gone as scholars have begun to think about early Christianity and who women and men were in early Christianity. In other words, it was really at the beginning of the feminist movement that this set of questions became pointed for the American and European public, and when scholars began to study this. This was also, of course, not accidentally, I think, a result of women scholars coming into the Guild of Biblical Scholars at that time. So there's been a lot of really important close examining of the biblical text and of other documents to try to get a little bit better fix on what it means to be women and men, especially together, in the early parts of Christianity in the New Testament era. In some ways, the first conclusions were the obvious ones. That is, that basically all of society, all of the Mediterranean society, out of which the early Christian literature comes, New Testament and all, we can classify as patrilineal, which means that the family goes through the father, its identity goes through the father. That's interesting, of course, because some of you may know that Judaism now is matrilineal. That is, you are a Jew if your mother is a Jew today. That wasn't the case in the first and second century. It was patrilineal. Also, it's clear that throughout the Mediterranean at that time, society was patrilocal, meaning that when marriages of the second generation happened, they followed where the father
or whether the, where the husband was. So the family moved into the husband's extended family. And the word that's used most for these kind of thinking, this kind of thinking about gender, and it was patriarchal, meaning it, the rulers of the society were men. It's interesting, just on that last phase, the more we've looked at it, it turns out that in this era, in exactly this era, and that's, I would say, the first century BC, at BCE, and the first century of CE or AD, and the second century, they start to give examples of women that are also ruling. So for instance, especially in the first century BCE and the first century CE in Egypt, you have, for the first time, you have queens who are not just there as the partners of the kings who are really in charge. But Egypt is run and ruled by and large for about 100 years by queens. And Israel, in the first century BCE, has its first queen that rules Israel for 7 years. That's right before Rome captures all of Israel and makes it a part of the Roman Empire. The other thing that closer looks have shown is in those three centuries, I mentioned this yesterday just briefly, in these three centuries, basically the centuries perhaps coincidentally when Christianity comes to birth, these three centuries mark the advent of, across the board, the rights to divorce by women. So for instance, there are, in the Hebrew scriptures, there are instructions for how you get a divorce. But that only applies to the men. So women in the Hebrew scriptures are not allowed to divorce, only men are. And men, basically the way you get divorced, according to the Hebrew scriptures, is the man says, I'm divorcing. That's it. That's the big legal process. The second thing that happens in this era is women begin to have the right to own property for the first time. And thirdly, the larger impression that in public, a woman shouldn't be seen except in the company of a male starts also to be reduced. So there are places within the Mediterranean during the first century where women now begin to appear alone without being automatically considered to be a prostitute or a shame to their family in one way or another. So curiously, during this time, you have a lot of movement towards, I wouldn't want to even think about it as equality or mutuality, but some additional rights for women during this era. By and large, that progress is rescinded after the second century CE or AD. So it's a kind of a blip for a while. Yes, Kristen.
Do you know if married women could own property?
Married women couldn't own property until this time.
Okay, because sometimes it's like, what, women could own property if they were by themselves, but as soon as they got married, the property was then their husband's.
No, married women, and it depends on the exact time and the exact location, but no, you have single women owning property as well in this time. And then that ground is basically lost after that. So one of the caricatures, because of course one of the things when we started saying, well, what does the New Testament say about women and men together? One of the things we clung to early on in the last 40 years was Paul's declaration that in Christ there is neither male nor female. All are one in Christ. And there it, we thought, wow, look, everybody else has the men ruling, but in Christianity, that's not the case. It turns out that we were kind of jumping the gun on that, that we've now found texts in Judaism that have indications of some mutuality between women and men. For instance, there's this wonderful treatise on the Therapeutai, a Jewish group in Egypt. And there, when they have their meal celebration and worship, the women and the men get to recline together, because that's what you do in worship, is you have a meal, and that you recline together, whereas before the women had to stand or to sit. So there are interesting examples in Gentile, Jewish, and Christian settings of some mutuality between women and men during this time. So it does not look as if it is Christianity itself that breaks this loose for more mutuality and equality. And I guess I would say, as far as I know, scholars don't really know why this happened. And it's kind of a blip on the screen. Staying with Paul, Paul has been one of the places where we found the most really interesting stuff around in gender relationships in the early churches. The first thing, of course, that people didn't have to try to find because it had been hit over their heads for centuries, was that in one place, Paul writes that women should not speak. That's in the book of 1 Corinthians. Now that, of course, when we looked at 1 Corinthians more closely, it turned out to be really confusing, because that's in chapter 14 of 1 Corinthians. However, in chapter 11, Paul has another restriction for women speaking, and that is if the women want to speak, they have to cover their heads. Now notice then chapter 11 and chapter 14 contradict one another. Now am I allowed to speak as a woman, or do I just have to cover my head? Furthermore, in 1 Corinthians, we have probably the tightest cluster of Paul mentioning women leaders in Corinth that he wants to greet. So for instance, he even says, in the first chapter, Paul said, and be sure to say hi to Chloe and all her people. And the Greek there, when you look at the Greek, it's basically saying Chloe and the organization she leads. And at the end of 1 Corinthians, Paul also greets several women as if they are the people who are to be respected. I guess I would want to say that scholars and others really have not figured out what to make of these different indications of the authority, leadership, and presence of women in the Corinthian associations and churches. It simply is contradictory. So if Chloe has a group that she's leading, how can she not speak? And then the whole thing about your head covered or not. But this does, of course, indicate that probably Paul, when he says, there's neither male nor female in Christ, but all are one, actually he has experienced some mutuality and some leadership of women and men in the groups that he is dealing with. I can say that when he goes to say that in Corinth, he drops that. In Galatians, he says, there's neither slave nor free, Jew nor Greek, male nor female, but all are one in Christ. But it looks like Paul, something's going on in Corinth. So Paul drops that there's neither male nor female in his correspondence to the Corinthians. So probably there are, in fact, really strong leaders in Corinth. And Paul doesn't know what quite to do with it. He finds himself affirming and denying that kind of leadership. We noticed on Monday when we looked at the Gospel of John how how there are very strong women who have actual names in John. In contrast to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where by and large the women, even when they are exemplary, don't have names. As we then read the Gospel of Mary this week alongside the Gospel of John, this gives a little bit of a context for what Mary's authority as the one that Jesus loves best and the one who knows the teachings that no one else does, how that might fit into a larger picture. I want to mention another gospel here, and I just alluded to this the other day. So there's been a lot of really important study on the Gospel of Luke relative to men and women. And you may know that most scholars think that Luke, when the Gospel of Luke is being written, the author of Luke has in front of him the Gospel of Mark. That is, we're pretty sure that the Gospel of Mark is the first gospel written. And as we sort of pored over that in the last 25 years, especially in the 1980s, one of the things we noticed is that in Luke, where Mark in the story has mentioned a man, 18 different places, Luke adds a woman. So in other words, it's like kind of today, it looks like Luke wants to insist on there being as many women in the story of Jesus as men. Didn't quite make it, but there's 18 different places where Luke adds a woman. So frankly, in the 1980s, when we were all fresh and really wanting to figure all this out, we said, aha, Luke's our gospel for mutuality among the genders. And even a number of folks were saying, maybe Luke was written by a woman. Because as we mentioned the last 2 days, basically, Luke is not mentioned in Luke, except in the title, and the title comes later in the copying process. So we thought, oh, we've got a gospel that shows us mutuality among the sexes and maybe even a woman's voice. So in the 1990s, when a number of us started really studying that more densely, it was somewhat disappointing, because we began to find that there's also silencing of women in Luke. So there's more presence of women and there's silencing of women. So for instance, the story of Mary and Martha when Jesus visits their house has that really kind of scary, for me, portrait of Mary is sitting at Jesus' feet quiet and Martha is managing the house. And Martha and Jesus have a little tussle as to whether her management of the house or whether Mary's being quiet and listening to him is the better role. It's a number of scholars came out of the 1990s saying the Gospel of Luke looks like it is, in fact, in the middle of an argument about how much leadership women might have. Again, the thing to remember about all of what I've just said is what I've said twice this week, is because we have so little real evidence, we scholars are just making most of this up, or at least half of it up. We can't really know. So I'm laying out a bunch of the evidence that we have and trying to learn, mainly, of course, because this matters to us and who we become, because the Bible has authority in many people's lives and is used for and against us in the way we develop as people, especially as men and women. So we're trying to sort of figure out what there is to learn about this. I'm going to stop there before we jump into the Gospel of Mary on this front and see any thoughts or questions that you all might have about this messy set of results.
So
Yes, John.
Comparing kind of the Gospels of Luke and John, is there kind of a consensus among scholars around which one seems to have a bit more mutuality? Like, does John seem to be a bit more that direction? Or?
Not a consensus. There's some really good arguments among scholars. I would say that women scholars are tending towards John right now, whereas early on, they did not. But it's far from any kind of consensus. Yeah. It's sort of a whole set of you know, deep desires for some real instruction on this, and so we tend to jump at things we find. I guess I want to say it's quite clear from the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of John that those communities, that these questions mattered to them too. Not exactly in the same way for us, but it's clear that there's what I would call contestation about women's presence and leadership. Yes, Nancy?
I don't remember how or somewhere along the line. I heard that there are documents, whatever, facts around the fact that as Jesus moved around, there were a lot of women as well as the 12 disciples, and that quite often they were the ones that, of course, fed them and paid for the food and that kind of thing. Is there documentation
on
that?
Yeah, it's in two places, both in Mark, but very explicitly in Luke. Luke actually uses the term that is best translated, that he says in chapter 8, that there were a group of women who financed Jesus. Now that term can also be translated served Jesus. In other words, how we translate that depends a lot on that. And it looks like Luke gets that from Mark and makes it a stronger statement. So I would want to. And Luke, by the way, names three women who finance or serve Jesus. And that's really a breakthrough too there. Whether those are real women or not is not clear, but that you have a name, would probably mean that the picture we would have from Luke is an aristocratic woman who finances a sage. Yeah, that's still in place, sort of.
I apologize for kind of making a tangent here, but how did the Acts of Thecla play into this? Because that's one place where there's quite a bit of empowerment to a lady.
Yeah, and I've done a lot of work on Thecla. Yes, that's a really important document. It's second century, probably written around the time of Luke 2 and Mary. So Thecla, and just to say to you all briefly, the Acts of Paul and Thecla, and you can find the text of it here, I'll leave this here, is this completely interesting story of Thecla, a teenager who decides to follow Paul. And her mother and her fiancé shut her down and say, you're not allowed to follow Paul and be like Paul. And she's even brought to trial because she refuses to be married and wants to follow Paul instead. That happens twice in this story. Finally, she succeeds in refusing her suitors and becoming a follower of Paul. Paul permits her to follow and to be with him in ministry, but he's really slow in baptizing her in this story, so she baptizes herself so that she can get on the road in this task. And she lives her whole life in this kind of ministry. So yes, Thecla is a very important document, and all of these three documents, Luke, the Gospel of Mary, and the Acts of Paul and Thecla, all seem to have been written in the early second century, probably somewhere between 100 and 125. So yeah, that's a part of the next step. Other thoughts or questions before we look at Mary again?
That photocopy you had of the Gospel of Mary, now is that like a Reader's Digest version or is that the whole thing?
This is, we every time I've handed this out, it's the whole thing. Oh. And as we said 2 days ago, the biggest problem is about 6.5 of the pages are missing. Six and a half, we call them columns of papyri are missing. So they've actually, the guy got them, these pages together, and he noticed that there were 6.5 pages missing, pulled kind of out. So some people want to see a conspiracy in that.
So how many existed then, were not missing?
Well, it's, here I'll show you this, and the whole text is here. But it's about, it's really only printed here, what, six pages here?
Right.
Take a look at it. Well, yeah, so
what percentage of that?
So I think they're about 60% of the book intact. So then let's ask this question about men and women of the Gospel of Mary. And here, of course, the big thing is that we mentioned this before, but not in these terms. So Mary is called first in the book, the woman Jesus loved most. And then at the end of the book, Levi calls her the disciple or the person that Jesus loved most. So, for instance, Karen King says that in terms of the 12 disciples, that this is probably a tradition that doesn't acknowledge the 12, but considers Mary to be a central leader and one of the core group. So that she is central to Jesus' affection, and by the way, again here, and I'll say a little bit more about this. No, I'll do the marriage thing in a minute about Jesus and Mary. But here she's portrayed simply as a thinker, a leader, and a spokesperson. And she knows that teachings and tells teachings that Jesus has told her privately. And she, however, then, when she says that, the story, and we should go into this in a little bit more detail. So Andrew and Peter, immediately after she finishes telling what Jesus told her, they say, this is not right. Something's wrong here. On two reasons, on two counts. One, this doesn't sound like Jesus. It's not the Jesus we heard. And I would want to say there's some sympathy to that because I would kind of say the same thing, that this is pretty different teaching than you would find in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Although you could also say that in John, right? Because there's hardly any teachings that are the same in John as there are in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And the second objection of Andrew and Peter is that how could Jesus ever have thought of telling this to a woman? In other words, what's really interesting about this this book is it portrays gender roles. I mean, it tells a story in which there is an emergence of a woman who is basically put down by the leading men of the Jesus movement. And then that precipitates another argument in which Levi takes Mary's side. So you've got a real explicit debate about whether you should recognize the teaching of Mary. One of the really interesting things about this picture is that it's not quite a caricature. In other words, you have men on both sides of this question, So Levi is an advocate for Mary. And at the same time, to a certain extent, some folks are worried that Mary herself disappears in the argument. So for instance, after Peter and Andrew challenge her, all she does is cry. Now this isn't stereotypical, because we remember that it was the disciples that cried first, and she comforted them. But after they challenge her, she doesn't say anything more for the rest of the story. And it's Levi who takes up her cause. So that could be kind of spooky in terms of her needing a male protector. But again, this is all, I think, really engaging in terms of us who are so caught up in how who we are as women and men. Because here's a real debate, and it's a sloppy debate. In other words, there's not real clear ending to it. Peter.
Is there, you know, have you considered that this is just a literary tactic? Because the people reading this might, you know, have those type of, you know, gender exclusive type of arguments themselves. And so the person who penned this actually put the argument in there and then had the disciples defend her. And so that, you know, that kind of shoots down that argument later on when the gospel is read.
Yeah, I guess I think I read all gospels in and outside of the canon that way, that we can't trust that the reports of what happened. There's all reports of something like that happened, I think, in and outside the canon, but they all have that kind of rhetorical strategy going. So yes, one can't read any of this literature, whether it's John, Mark, or Mary, or Paul and Thecla, without saying, what's the rhetorical strategy here by the writers themselves? That's absolutely key. But here, what I guess I'm saying in the Gospel of Mary, if you say, so what's the writer wanting to portray? It's a pretty complex thing that he or she is trying to portray. Let's say a little bit about Jesus and Mary Magdalene. As we said earlier, for those of you who weren't here, we think this is Mary Magdalene. The text doesn't say it. We're sure that it's not Mary the mother. So the term love in Coptic that's used here is not the erotic word, but it does indicate deep affection. It can be used for married man and woman, or it can be used for brother and sister, for instance, as well. So that word doesn't solve much. The Da Vinci Code uses the Gospel of Mary as evidence that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married. And frankly, it seems to me that that was a stretch there. And from my point of view, it takes away the importance of Mary Magdalene, because her importance is being Jesus' wife rather than a leader, an early Christian leader. It is true that now more literature is emerging on, especially in the second century, about Jesus and Mary being married. So I've been always grumpy about anybody who wants to say the Gospel of Mary shows Jesus and Mary married, because I think it takes away from the seriousness of Mary. But you do have, in the Gospel of Philip, which is in the Nag Hammadi collection, you have a portrait of Mary Magdalene and Jesus in relationship. And there, the word, you guys are going to love this, the Coptic word corresponding to koinonia is used for the relationship between Mary and Jesus. That root word means, of course, as you all know, really tight and affectionate community. It's also one of the root words for sex. So that Jesus and Mary have koinonia, and he's just sort of, in the Gospel of Philip, you begin thinking about that. And then here's this is a scholarly joke. So the Gospel of Philip, remember I was pointing out the lacuna, the holes in the text? So on this one page of the Gospel of Philip, you have about Jesus and Mary, and he used to kiss her on the blank. So the scholarly word for the blank in the page is lacuna. So we now say he used to kiss her on the lacuna. It does look like, in terms of the space, that it might mean lips. But frankly, that also doesn't. Kissing is also a literary image of agreeing, and men are kissing each other all the time in the Gospel. But it is, of course, it makes you think. And then there is the Gospel of Jesus, the fragment that was discovered in the last 2 years, you probably read about it, the Gospel of Jesus' wife. Anybody heard about that? So yeah, it's been covered in the New York Times and a whole bunch of places. I've actually held this fragment in my hand. It's about that big, and Karen King basically is in charge of it now at the Harvard Museum, and there's been a lot of interesting conversation about it. But there, Jesus says in a broken sentence, Jesus says, my wife, the word in Coptic used only for wife, and Jesus says, she is worthy to be my disciple. Both of those are really pretty important things. So, but it's just this little piece, like 32 words. It's just a fragment. And the Vatican immediately said it was a forgery. And then 3 months later, the guy who made that judgment for the Vatican recanted. Karen King's having the ink and the papyrus tested right across the street from my office at Columbia. And so they're in the middle of trying to figure out whether it's a fraud or not. So it's too early for us to use that in any definitive ways. Again, I probably would want to say, in terms of the larger conversation that churches need to have about women's leadership and biblical and Christian texts that help us think about that, I still am really hesitant to rush towards Jesus and Mary Magdalene being married, just because that might caricaturize her own authority. All right.
That document that you're talking about, that talks about his wife, and do we know that that's from what's on there? Do we know that he's talking about Mary, or do we not even know who he's talking about?
It's the word Mary occurs in the fourth line down from when he says it. But again, here the problem is that, as we said all this week long, Mary is the name of 25% of the women in Galilee. So this does not say Mary Magdalene. By the way, the Gospel of Philip does say Mary Magdalene. It's just a little too early to do that. And we're not going to settle this with the 36-word fragment. It does help us think a little bit about this relationship with in the Gospel of Mary, between Jesus and Mary, because there, I would say, for me, that if the fragment is authentic, him saying she is worthy to be my disciple is at least as important as him saying my wife.
Well, I was going to ask, because you've said a couple times how maybe if she was his wife, that sort of puts a cloud over her importance as a leader in the movement, and that I understand that what you're saying is true in terms of how she might be interpreted, that bothers me,
Me too.
Like, why can't she be his wife and be a literary
movement? Right. And so, for instance, my wife is a pretty famous preacher. And it's always kind of nice to go behind her, because everybody knows she's a great preacher. So it's not the fact that we're married to each other doesn't put either of us down in a decent way.
Well, and I wonder too, like what Peter brought up about the literary device. I mean, these documents are written a couple hundred years after Jesus is gone, and these are people trying to sort of make points, and they're not necessarily telling exact fact for fact objective versions of what happened. And is it possible that Mary maybe wasn't his wife, but then they sort of said she was to kind of make a point about, you know, I mean,
right.
Who knows, right?
Yeah, and I it's clear that all of Christian literature, I mean, I'm just, I haven't told you this cliche of my formation. I studied with a professor of New Testament early on in my career, who eventually became a cardinal in the Roman Catholic Church. And he used to say to us in our courses, he said, thank God they didn't write down what happened. Thank God they wrote down what it meant. In other words, it seems to me that what matters about Scripture is that they're taking people's lives that are going to read it seriously. And so yes, absolutely, that's really what is what we need to remember, is that this is mostly about how the early Christians figured out who they were. It's not a journalist. And my time's up. I apologize. Tomorrow we'll go on to look at kind of a bigger picture of canon and non-canon.
Thank you.
Thank you.